America leads the world in medicine development. It matters. We get new medicines first, nearly 3 years faster. 5 million Americans go to work because we make medicines here at home. And not relying on other countries keeps us safe. But China is racing to overtake us. Will we let them, or will we choose to stay ahead? When America leads, America cures. Let's tell Washington to keep us in the lead.
Learn how at americacures.com. Paid for by Pharma.
All right, everyone, we have a very special guest joining us this week on Inside Boxing Live. He is a friend to you if you are a boxing fan. He's a friend of mine because I've been around this sport not as long as our guest that's coming on right now. And I wanted to get him on for a number of reasons because he's returning to the broadcast booth on May 2nd, a triumphant return, because he has a new book out on April 15th chronicling his life in boxing, and because he is a great friend of George Foreman, who tragically passed away this weekend. Of course, I'm talking about Jim Lampley. Mr. Jim, how are you, my friend?
Dan, I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing okay. I mean, the Foreman news kind of came out of nowhere.
I just said I'm doing well because that's what I always say. The fact of the matter is I'm having a struggling few days here, and it's really been tough because this came completely out of left field. I had no idea he was ill in any way, and mm-hmm. It was a shock.
Yeah, it was a shock because, you know, 76 years old is young, and when you think of George Foreman, you think of a larger-than-life Superman figure hitting the heavy bag. I saw on Instagram just like a few months ago, I feel like, larger-than-life figure. So it did come as a shock, and I know you guys were such good friends and colleagues, and I got to know George a little bit when I was younger, but man, I mean, it just hurt. Like, this one really, it stopped you dead in your tracks when I got the news via his Instagram page.
Yeah, you say 76, and it reminds me that I'm 75. And George and I had an interesting little routine that went off and on for years. He would pretty constantly refer to me as young man. Yep, he referred to me in the third person as young man. This young man did that. Or he would call me young man to my face. And almost every time it happened, I would find the right moment to say, George, you're born on January 10, 1949. I'm born on April 8, 1949. There are less than 3 months difference there. so the notion that I'm somehow much younger than you is way off base. And he would always just brush it off and say, yeah, but you're such a young man. So now here we are in this situation. He's gone. I was 3 months younger, or 3 months. Yeah. 3 months younger. And you know, it makes you wonder about your own mortality. But again, I have learned within the past few days that George had some problems, had some challenges, and this did not come just completely as one lightning stroke out of the blue. That there was a buildup.
Yeah, and it stopped people in their tracks in the sports world, stopped people in their tracks in the entertainment world, just in life. We're talking about a larger than life figure, and a big reason for that is how he transformed himself. Because there is a large generation of people out there, Jim, that only know George Foreman as, oh, that's the guy with the grill. Oh, that's the guy. That's the smiley man with the hamburgers and the Midas touch. And it's wild. The length of his life and what he did with those 76 years, the ups and downs, it's an American life. Is that what I'm saying?
It's brilliant of you to say that, Dan, because he reflects so many things about our culture. And the most amazing thing about him was the way that he transformed and reconstructed his own personality to achieve what he wanted to achieve as a human being, not as a fighter, and channeled his life in a direction that no one would ever have believed. Even in the process of rebuilding his ring career to get himself into position to fight for the legitimate heavyweight championship of the world, there was an element of happy talk and clownishness in it. He went on what I called the happy tour, where he fought all of these worn out, used up, former opponents of lesser distinction than him. But if he knocked them out, he was continuing this streak and building his reputation and his persona. And then eventually he found a moment. He took a fight against Evander Holyfield, which was a legitimate heavyweight battle. And they fought in Atlantic City, and it was a tremendous fight. Holyfield won the fight, which was to be expected. But the one who gained credibility was George, because he was right there with him. And he was a problem for Holyfield. And you could see this guy is real again. And he has gotten back to the level where maybe he can fight for the title. And eventually, you know, Michael Moore upset Evander Holyfield. And his first thought, of course, was how do I make the most possible money for a title defense? And it was obvious. You make the most possible money for a title defense if you fight this global happy figure. And so Moore chose to fight George Foreman. Careful what you wish for.
We will get to that. It's a big part of this interview. It's a big part of your life. It's a big part of your book that's coming out next month. It's all weaves in together. Big part of your return to the broadcast booth on May 2nd. It's crazy how boxing can do that. I know we're jumping around a little bit, but you know what? With the comeback tour that you know, I found interesting too, and it's so much different than boxing today. Like George Foreman comes back. He declares that he's coming back. In what year was that? In the late 80s?
Yeah.
1987. He doesn't get that first title shot till 1991. And then he doesn't get the second title shot against Moore until 1994.
Right.
Then today's boxing, a name like George Foreman, he's skyrocketing. Like they're giving him a title shot within maybe a year. So you want to laugh at what George Foreman did, right? He's fighting these bums. He's going on this tour. I mean, this was a legitimate comeback. He was doing it the way you should do it, like when meritocracy did exist in boxing.
Absolutely right. I throw into that just as a sidelight observation. What if somebody with George's creativity and personality and thought process had immersed himself in social media? They didn't exist at the time of the Happy Tour and the time when.
What about Ali? If Ali had Instagram,
he would have been the biggest Instagram figure in the world.
Because probably would have been more hated.
He was so lovable. And understood how to be both a destroyer and a lovable destroyer. He could play both roles. And the way I've said it earlier today is he knew how to be the story and write the story. And it takes a gift as a public figure to understand how to do that. But George could do it. He wrote his own story. He was the story. He climaxed the story in the way that nobody thought he could. He dreamed the impossible dream and made it come true. It's a great American story, one of the greatest of our lifetimes, and we're lucky that we knew him.
Yeah, I consider myself very lucky. But talk a little bit about the two Georges. The 1970s George, who was not the guy that you saw on your television, was legitimately someone that Madison Avenue would steer clear of. They would say, we don't want this guy. We don't want this guy endorsing our product. He's scary. He's mean.
Right. Well, he came from the Fifth Ward of Houston. And the Fifth Ward of Houston was one of those neighborhoods, you know, like the South Side of Chicago or the South Bronx in New York, et cetera, where young men were trained not to be outstanding, achieving citizens. They were trained to be something else. And George, as a teenager, came to realization that this is a dead end. I don't want to go down this path and ruin my life. I need to reconstruct. And he chose to go to the Job Corps. He went to Hayward, California, on an adventure, basically, to go to the Job Corps. And that's where he learned to box. He was trained as an amateur boxer in the Job Corps. He went straight from the Job Corps to the Olympics and won his gold medal and waved his American flag. And the whole time he was writing his own story, one of the most amazing things he ever told me was that in his year and a half in Hayward, California, the Job Corps, he had a friend who was a big Bob Dylan fan. And George got into Bob Dylan and started listening to all the albums and memorizing the lyrics. And I checked him on it because I'm a Dylan guy. I checked him. I said, okay.
You would, Jim. You would.
Tell me the lyrics for, you know, this particular song, et cetera, et cetera. And he knew him. And he was not fibbing about that. He had, in fact, memorized Bob Dylan lyrics. So we're talking about, you know, if you were to make your list of the five most unusual human beings you ever met, he's a given. You can start with him and then go anywhere else. That's how unusual he was.
George, yeah, unusual life. To go from that mean heavyweight champion of the world to do what he did to Joe Frazier, the fights with Muhammad Ali, and then just straight up quitting. And just not just quitting and like and just kind of disappearing, going into the become an ordained minister. Like that life, if you gave me a script, I would say, nah, this is kind of, you know, this is a little over the top.
Hokey, right?
Yeah, I mean, there is a movie out about his life.
A little bit too goody two shoes, right?
Yeah, I'm like, that's heavyweight cool. Champion that just disappears. He becomes an ordained minister. He comes back. He becomes the oldest heavyweight champion in the world. He becomes an amazing pitchman to up his worth to over $300 million. Lives like that just don't come along. And that's what made George, he was so unique. He was just like a larger than life, unique man. And that's why I think so many,
absolutely.
I think that's right. And that's why so many people have just kind of stopped dead in their tracks when they got that news. And
have
the reflection has been great.
Power? Have we talked about punching power, Dan? Because I think he, you know, one of his distinctions is he ranks among the five biggest punchers ever in the heavyweight division. And one thing I love to try to explain to people when we talk about George is that George saw punching power not just as a physical property. George saw it as a science, that mm-hmm. there were things you needed to understand about timing and leverage and positioning and the angle of the punch, et cetera, that would contribute to the effect in the ring. So what the layman sees is a big, strong guy who hits like a mule and therefore knocks people out. But what George was seeing in himself was a guy who knew the footwork and the timing and the leverage and the balance and all the various factors that went into the science of power, because it was a science for him.
Yeah, you look at that Mora shot, that was such a compact, it barely looked like he touched him and he went down. But then you look at him in the 70s, what he did to Frazier, he was doing looping shots. But back in the 70s, he probably had more brute strength. Although you could probably argue maybe it did carry into his 40s, but his style looked a little different in the 70s than when I saw in that Mora fight. When
much
I saw in the
more
90s.
Precise in the Mora fight, much more compact, much more well-schooled and self-schooled on the techniques that were necessary to maximize power. Yeah, the guys that he got rid of with those looping punches in the 70s, he'd have gotten rid of them more quickly if he had known what he learned in the 80s.
Well, Jim, you weren't 100% involved in boxing when he decided to step away. Did you think that he would come back? What was the general feeling when George decided to step away from boxing?
Well, I didn't know him at that time, so I had no idea whether he would return or not. I grew to know him after the Happy Tour when he came back and developed a new persona and then went on to become championship contender. I did not think he would be a competent or effective expert commentator on our telecast. I was wrong. He worked, he went to the fighter meetings, he paid attention to what people said, he got interested in the personalities of the different fighters, and of course he always had that orientation to craft and technique that he was never given enough credit for. So he fit in perfectly with Larry and me, and we had a great time working with him, and then when he was ready to leave, he was ready to leave, and he walked away.
I want to tell a story. So there were a few birthdays growing up where you guys were on the road at HBO. My father created CompuBox. Bob Kenobi was on the road with you guys. And obviously, he was feeling pretty bad that he's missing his son's birthday, or I would hope that he was feeling bad that he was missing his son's birthday. And we got a call at the house, and my mom would say, Dan, dad's on the phone. And I would run downstairs, grab the phone, and it wasn't my dad. It would be George. And George would say, hey, son, or hey, champ. I hear it's your birthday. Your dad tells me you're blah, blah, blah. You know, be a good, listen to your mother and happy birthday. And I would think that, wow, that
how
is
good. The, is that? How that good, is how priceless is that, right? I mean, you have something, that. You, he's gone, but you have that. So
yes,
utterly priceless and, you know, goes along with everything we've said about this one of a kind giant personality.
But I feel like that's just one story. You know, I was a lucky kid that got to be around boxing, very fortunate. I feel like there's so many other stories with George, because he was this larger-than-life figure. He just was a humanitarian. I feel like he could have ran for president. I feel like, you know, he kind of was in a way. You know, like in today's politics, he probably could have fit right in terms of the, you know, being so bold and out there. But I feel like there's so many other stories out there. And obviously, the listeners know about, you know, his accolades inside of the ring. But if there's any stories that you would like to share about George that we would find interesting, you know, outside of the public eye.
We were at ringside for a fight one night in Las Vegas. It was a period of time in my life when I had been living in Park City, Utah. And I had dispensed with Hollywood, Southern California. I knew I was done with it. I wanted to ski as much as I possibly could. I took my wife, who was a thrillingly effective professional news anchor, and we moved to Park City, where I spent a lot of money to create a restaurant. And I skied 110 days the first year, skied my hip into sawdust, et cetera, et cetera. And I bought eventually, because my wife didn't want to drive down the hill to take the kids to school in snowstorms, I bought a house on the flats at the bottom of the hill. It was the first big, beautiful house you saw when you drove into Park City. I was crazy about it. And a few months after we moved into that house, that particular wife decided that she wanted to go back to news anchoring, and she got a job from a station in San Diego, and now she wanted to move out of Park City and go to San Diego to go back on the air. And I was selfish. I was infuriated by it. And I was at ringside before a fight, and I was complaining and bitching about it, and particularly bitching about the fact that I would have to sell this massive house that I had just bought for her, specifically so that she wouldn't have to drive down the hill, etc. And George heard the conversation. He stepped over to me, put that giant hand on my shoulder. And he said, "Jim, it's a thing. It's not a person. It's not a relationship. It's not something that you're really going to miss in your life if you think about it. It's a house. You have owned houses before. You will own houses in the future. There's no way you should allow that to disrupt your relationship with this woman who loves you." He was right. It was classic, simple wisdom of the kind that he had and was willing to give to a friend. You know, he didn't know whether I was going to like it or not, but he just told me, focus. This is common sense. Don't get out over your ski tips the way that you are. And it, you know, it showed me that he was really my friend, that we really did have a bonded personal relationship. And in the years that followed, there were several, we were closer because of that one conversation.
It must mean so much more when it comes from him, right?
Obviously, yes. And the other thing was, he used to call me young man. Did I tell you about that?
Yep.
I did. Okay. So calling me young man all the time, it was a personal affectation of his. I knew that it was a mark of affection, but I also knew that he was kind of getting to me.
I mean, I would listen. I would when he spoke, you listened. Like that's the
100%.
Thing.
Yeah, you always gravitas. What he had to say.
Another memory of mine growing up was I wasn't at this fight, probably thankfully, was the brawl at Madison Square Garden between Riddick Bowe and Andrew Gallada, and what George did in terms of becoming like an enforcer, bouncer, father figure, you know, just an all around badass that night.
He put an arm bar out behind me at ringside. I worked for several minutes at ringside talking, describing what I was seeing and not realizing what was going on behind me. People were running through the aisles of the garden, trying to get close to the ring. And some of them were actually climbing into the ring. And George was standing behind me with an arm bar behind me so that they wouldn't jostle me. They wouldn't knock me over. They wouldn't step on me as they were trying to get into the ring. And he was constantly talking to these. They were all men. He was constantly talking to all of these men. Don't go in there. You shouldn't do that. There's nothing you can accomplish by going in there. You're only going to get in trouble, et cetera. He was trying very, very hard to be the kind of peacemaker that, you know, somebody with his size and wherewithal and image could be. And those who stopped and looked at him and realized who was giving them this advice and what it meant, some of them did, in fact, turn around and go away from the ring. And I, of course, I wound up with my body all in one piece and never really felt any of the physical threat that George was protecting me from with one long arm held out behind my back.
Amazing. Yeah, I remember my dad was telling me when I was texting with him on Friday night, like, yeah, he said he stayed close to George because he wanted to protect the computer, he wanted to protect himself, but he knew that no one was going to be messing with George that night.
Ever. You'd have to be crazy. You know, even he was who he was.
Even at that, what was that, 96?
Yeah.
It was only
July 11, 1996. Good memory, Dan.
So that's only 2 years after he won the heavyweight title. So he was still formidable, George.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Was he still competing at that time? I'm pretty sure he fought until what, 97, 98, I want to say?
I don't remember. I don't even have a specific graphic memory of what happened after the Moore fight. You know, to me, it's that one story, the one night, the impossible dream. George doing what he said he would do. You watch, he'll come to stand in front of me and let me knock him out. It's uncanny.
Unbelievable. That is the title of your book, It Happened. It's coming out April 15th. It has even more meaning now. I know that you're not, I mean, this is unfortunate symmetry here between George passing and the release of your book. But
there's
in
more
this
than
book-
that. The title of the book comes from my call of his fight. The first thing you read in the book is the prologue. The prologue is about the 19-year-old me watching the 19-year-old him win his Olympic gold medal in Mexico City. There are various other connections. The blurb that he wrote for the cover of the book that appears right above Billie Jean King and below John Grisham may have been his last public act. His son said to me last night that he thought for sure that was the last thing he did in public, was to write the blurb for my book. So that's why I'm having trouble controlling my emotions. It's because I'm about to publish this autobiography, which in certain little ways here and there is as much about George as it is about me. And that's very moving to me at this moment in time.
It's wild. It really is wild to me.
It happened.
It happened. That word, I mean, I know the story behind it, and I have a great piece of content where you relate it to me, and I put some graphics over it, and I put it on Instagram. I put it on Twitter over the weekend, and it has a lot of views, and it has a lot of people understanding that moment because it's right. I mean, we've been over the story of the call so many times with you, but such a succinct two words, it happened, can explain so much about that moment, your career,
you've got
Foreman's life.
Okay. I mean, when Cortez's count reaches five or six and I'm looking at Moore, he's not getting up. So this is a cosmic event. This is George Foreman regaining the heavyweight championship 20 years after he lost it to Ali, you know, in circumstances where no one would have predicted that this was going to happen. And now I have to put a caption to this picture. I have to come up with some meaningful call that says what went on here. And for whatever reason, the words that come into my mind are, it happened. And I said it twice. It happened. It happened, and it's the greatest call of my career, no question. But, you know, it was the product of maybe a second and a half of consideration.
Well, if you think about it, Jim, if you sat up the night before, like I know some broadcasters do, and you would have scripted something out, it wouldn't have hit as hard. It wouldn't have resonated.
It wouldn't have been as concrete. It wouldn't have been as people hear it happened, and they can feel the spontaneity of it. That's part of what made it effective. So I never was the person who sat up and wrote something that I expected to use the next day. I wanted to let it be naturalistic, and I got lucky. I got lucky with it happened.
What are some of your other favorite calls? Bang. I know the bang, we talked about
that. I like the bang. There was somebody in the truck who didn't like bang, bang, bang. They eventually got a pushback from the truck on
they're wrong.
Bang, bang, bang. I was trying to say something that made clear how repetitively effective Pacquiao was, and how there was impact there, that, you know, even though he's a little guy, Manny Pacquiao could really hit. So that's where bang, bang came from. Mike Tyson has been knocked out. Mike Tyson has been knocked out is very meaningful to me because, of course, it's hugely dramatic moment, one of the biggest moments in heavyweight history. And I'm saying to myself, I don't want to overact. I'm hearing my friend Jack Nicholson on the golf course saying to me, don't overact. So with don't overact in my head, I wind up saying, Mike Tyson has been knocked out, in just about that tone of voice. And
well, that's how quiet it was.
Every once in a while, I'll look at it. Once a year, I'll look at it and say, would you change that? Nah, I don't think so. I think that was exactly what to say.
That's beautiful. And it was pretty quiet in that Tokyo Dome. So maybe
that's the thing. They weren't making any noise at all, you know? So if I had shouted something, it would have felt like a fool.
They would have heard you up at the top.
34,000 silent Japanese sitting and watching. And I say, Mike Tyson has been knocked out. That's that.
That is wild. Going back to George, once he becomes the heavyweight champion, his life changes. He gets offered the grill. And I believe I told you this at another time. Hulk Hogan was originally the person that they had in mind to be the pitch man for this grill. I don't know what the deal was that, whether he turned it down or he has bad management. I would not be shocked by either of the two. But it goes into George's hands. And another personal story I had was we get a package sent to the house. And it's this big package. And we open it up. My dad goes, oh, this is a grill that George is now like part of. And this is like 1995. And me and my brothers are looking at it like, this thing looks like what is this contraption? Like, this, what is this thing? Like, it was the first, like, the prototype. He had sent it to all the HBO employees in 1995. And we didn't know what it was. We didn't know that it would go on to be what it was and turn George into the second act or maybe the third act of his career. That was just a wild time, too. Like, what George became post-1994 was remarkable.
All a part of his ongoing self-constructed personality transformation. You know, the changes in George Foreman were governed by George Foreman. Nobody else was telling him what to do or how to smile or how to wave or how to be the person whom the audience would fall in love with to the degree that they did. That was all self-generated from his own internal genius.
So when George joined HBO, he was a massive figure. He was a star. Boxing was much more popular than it is these days. So he was a big star. On top of it, with all the success as a pitch man, you said that you weren't exactly sure if it was gonna work as him as a broadcaster. And that's not really, I don't want to speak for you, but that's not really a knock on George. That's just when there are athletes of that stature, they usually aren't the best broadcasters, and they usually don't make for the best coaches because it's just they're just too big. They just have too much success in their career.
They're distracted.
But he turned into
distracted by their lives. They might not do the kind of research and thought process that it takes to be a really great expert commentator. And yes, they don't share the same experience that the everyday ball player or the everyday fighter has had in his life because they were extraordinarily gifted. But George was so focused on the human part of fighting. George was so focused on personality and people's lives and how they'd gotten into the ring and everything. He didn't have a problem being an expert commentator, because he was interested in human beings. And if he was interested in human beings, he was willing to tell their story. You know, if you were doing baseball with Joe DiMaggio or Mickey Mantle, you might not have expected them to have the curiosity about other people that is necessary to be great. That's why I was doing baseball with Bob Uecker and Bill White, they, you know, who were great men, but with different kinds of backgrounds that didn't involve all that kind of praise and adulation. I thought George would be in some ways warped by his adulation. He was exactly the opposite. He was naturally curious. He was human and humane. He was a great expert commentator.
He was. And there's a lot of people out there, a lot of generation out there that only knows him from that. So that just shows you the depth of his life, is that there are people out there that know him as the 1970s brawler, scary heavyweight. There's people out there that know him as an ordained minister. There are people that know him as, oh, that's the guy, that, the old champ. That's the old heavyweight guy, right? Didn't he have a great moment? Then there's the guys that know him as, oh, that's the guy that sells me cheeseburgers and on the Foreman grill. It's just, that's wild to have that many life turns.
Very much so. And again, a product of his openness, his natural curiosity, his willingness to explore new things in his life, and his interest in people. He was always interested in who are we going to meet next, and what is this person going to be like, and that's a tremendous platform from which to go out and do commentary.
I'll tell you what, man. I mean, I do some broadcasting myself. Like the people you meet, like in these fighter meetings, like the coaches, the team around them, the fighters themselves. There are some very interesting people. So I could see how George would gravitate to that.
Absolutely right. He understood that very well. And you know, if you would walk into a room with 9 famous people and one guy sitting in the corner who does not seem to fit in or mean anything, who would George go to quiz and interview? He would go to that person, because he would start from the premise that he already knew everything he needed to know about these other famous people. They're famous like him, so they've been exposed. Who is this person? You know Tammy Cotell. Yeah. Tammy Cotell was definitely George's best friend on our telecast. You know, she was the woman who went to the dressing room to tell the fighters that they had to exit at a certain time, you know, who went to the judges to get their official scores at the end of the fight. She was a high-priced errand girl. I hope she was high-priced, because she was indispensable. But George's biggest personal concern in every fight is, Tammy okay? How can I help Tammy? Where's Tammy? So, I mean, that's just the kind of a person he was.
Thank you, Jim, because that's what I wanted our audience to understand. Because we know about his life. We know about his accolades. Like I said, we know everything about him. But I wanted you to kind of bring out the other side of George that we didn't know about. And I think he did a wonderful job at that. And we're talking about you as a broadcaster working alongside George Foreman for all those years at HBO. A question that I always get asked whenever they find out that, you know, we had worked together at PPV.com. The question that you were asked, I hear the questions that you were asked every time you entered the rooms in Vegas, the media centers. When is Jim Lampley going to call a fight? When is Jim Lampley going to come back and broadcast a fight? Well, guess what? He is. May 2nd in Times Square. Yes. It's going to happen again. But that's what we're going to call it, Jim. It happened. It's going to happen again. May 2nd, Jim Lampley is getting behind the mic. How excited are you to
Very excited. Back? Excited, first of all, about the venue. I mean, I think it's creative and thoughtful and exciting to be holding the fight in Times Square. And, of course, Dan, you know the history of outdoor fights. Going back to Jess Willard and Jack Dempsey in Havana, and going through the fights in Yankee Stadium, the Polo Grounds, et cetera, et cetera. It's a long history of interesting background. I mean, the most interesting thing that ever happened in a fight that I called outdoors was in Yankee Stadium when Yuri Foreman was fighting Miguel Cotto. Foreman's corner threw in the towel, and Arthur McCanny Jr. picked the towel up and threw it back out.
I've never seen that. Have you ever seen
Nobody's like ever that? Seen it. Nobody's ever seen it.
That's a Mercanti move. I
don't understand what Arthur was thinking.
But he wanted to get some shine. He's like, hey.
Strange things happen in outdoor fights. So, I mean, you know, Toledo, Ohio. Jack Dempsey versus Jess Willard. And what did he knocked out 11 of his teeth in the first round or something like that. So I'm very excited about going back. I'm excited about the doubleheader. I'm excited to be working for Turki Alalshehk, who's doing great things for the sport of boxing. And I hope that I am still acceptably competent as a blow-by-blow person. If I'm not, it's because I've been away too long. If I can then I wasn't away too long.
Do you have any doubts in your mind? Because you are one of the best to ever do it, but you're also human. We're all human. Do you have any doubts, Jim?
Wouldn't be healthy not to have doubts, okay? I don't think it would be healthy for me or for my process of getting ready to do this if I was 100% certain that I was going to go back and be competent. I will study. I will work. I want to say like never before, but I think that I've probably worked pretty hard in the past. I always, from the very beginning, had a sort of apprehension about, you know, am I going to be okay? Am I going to fit in this sport? Because I know some people thought that I wouldn't. And to wind up gaining the level of acceptance and even acclaim that I gained as a blow-by-blow announcer is thrilling to me. But now I've got to go back and do it again. And I'm going to dig in and work. I'm going to look at all the numbers from people like you, because we have these wonderful new tools now, courtesy of CompuBox, to know what's going on in fights. And I, you know, the only thing I can promise is that I will go into May 2 as well-versed and as prepared informationally in advance as has ever been the case for any fight or set of fights that I've called, because I'm scared.
I love that. We should all have that, even someone of your stature. But I want to say this, though, Jim. Like, the fighters love you still. Like, we got to work together at PPV.com. I know you have a lot of admiration for Dale Hopkins, the CEO of PPV.com. This is a PPV.com-powered podcast, and I watched it for the last year. Fighters, when they come over to our table, and they show you love, they show you respect. Everyone from Tank Davis to David Benavidez, up and down the teams. So if you're questioning where do I stand in this sport, I think it's been cemented. And I saw it with my own eyes that you are a legend of the game, and the fighters still look at you as, oh, wow, that's Jim Lampley. He's going to be calling my fight. So I just want to tell you right now, like, you're going to fit in just fine.
Well, I'm deeply appreciative of how I have been treated by the fighters. And I've made some new friends whom I treasure and who I will regard as friends for a long time. David Benavidez is one of them. Caleb Plant is another one. There are a variety of fighters whom I didn't know before, whom I've gotten to know as the result of PPV.com. And all credit to Dale Hopkins at PPV.com, because she brought me back. She put me back in the media room. She put me back at ringside. She gave me the opportunity to gain whatever currency I now have with the existing group of fighters. And I also saw some whom I had met along the way during my HBO tenure. But it's very, very exciting to be back in the unique human laboratory of boxing, meeting the wonderful, uniquely talented and uniquely lovable people who exist in the sport of boxing. It's where I belong. And I'm very grateful to Turki Alalshehk for putting me back at ringside to do blow by blow.
Is there any details on what other roles you'll be playing besides the blow by blow? Will there be anything else?
I will leave that to the governing organization of Turki Alalshehk and TKO to establish that. I don't even know yet who I'm working with. I have asked, but I'm not sure who I'm going to be with on the air.
Fans are going to be excited. May 2nd, you are back in the broadcast booth. It's wild. It's very fun. It adds a lot of intrigue to what is already an intriguing night, like you said. Times Square, New York. It will happen. It's going to happen again. So I want royalties. I want royalties on your next book. I just gave you the next title. But if you want to buy the book right now, It Happened, A Uniquely Lucky Life in Sports Television. It releases on April 15th. Thank you so much for joining. You know, you're perfect timing for this episode, because there are a lot of boxing fans out there that wanted to either reflect on George's life, learn more about George's life, hear from you, talk about your return to the sport, want to go out and buy the book. It's just perfect symmetry, like I said. And Jim, I look forward to seeing you May 2nd. I enjoyed being your colleague at PPV.com. It was pretty damn cool. Full circle moment for me growing up around you as a kid. So, yeah, we're keeping the party going on May 2nd.
Boxing is the sport of full circles. Thank you, Dan.
Monster Energy. Everybody knows White Monster, Zero Ultra. That's the OG. It kicked off this whole zero sugar energy drink thing. But Ultra is a whole lineup now. You've got Strawberry Dreams, Blue Hawaiian, Sunrise, and Vice Guava. And they all bring the Monster Energy punch. So if you've been living in the white can, branch out. Ultra's got a flavor for every vibe. And every single one is zero sugar. Tap the banner to learn more.